David, it's 10 years since BSE, or mad cow disease, became an issue in Alberta. And at that time, it was all about cows and beef. A lot has changed since that time. Where are we now?
Well, we have made the progress in the field. We understand more about prion diseases. I think the emphasis is shifting a little bit. We have some concerns about a different type of prion disease called chronic wasting disease that lives in wild deer, feral deer, but also in farm deer, and it can also affect elk. And there's also laboratory studies that it can infect caribou. So there's a bit of unease as to whether this type of prion disease is spreading through these animal populations. Some early experiments indicated it might not be a problem insofar that it can transmit into humans, but we also know some new things about it, that there's not just one type of chronic wasting disease, and unfortunately it may evolve. So I think the final version on whether a chronic wasting disease is a human health threat, it's not quite resolved. There could be a problem that's going to confront us in the future. So that does affect the animal populations in Alberta and Saskatchewan. That's where it's been found, and generally could be a problem in the boreal ecosystems. The other thing that's happened is that we have a greater understanding that some of the ideas about how a prion disease works and how this type of agent spreads from brain cell to brain cell, turns out that some of these concepts apply to common human degenerative brain diseases, and by common I mean Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, and also another fairly common human dementia that has a jargon name of a tauopathy, that all of these diseases seem to employ prion-like mechanisms, and that wasn't really foreseen. In fact, I think if one had been asked that question 10 years ago, the response would have been, well, this is just wishful thinking by the prion biologists that their line of research is extremely useful and generalizable. But in fact, that has come to pass. It's becoming almost a dogma that these other diseases, at least part of their unfolding, their life cycle, involves prion-like mechanisms. So that is something quite unexpected, but I think generally has some good potential that we can take what we know about prion disease and use it again, as it were, to effect. And the other thing that has happened is that there's a line of research, what we might call the regular prion protein. So in a prion disease, there's a protein, a small molecule, like a ball of wool that gets in the wrong shape, but it has a benign precursor that we all have in our brain cells. What was unexpected is this benign precursor molecule may also feature in the chain of events in Alzheimer's disease. So that was also quite unexpected, and that is an area of active investigation.
It seems like this whole thing with prions has become very far-reaching. It touches all kinds of different areas. What is it then? What was that turning point that gave you this sense of connection, that all of these different things were connected?
Actually, I think there were a few turning points in the past decade. We understand more about how prions spread from cell to cell, and in a way, the prion disease that is most infectious, most contagious, is this chronic wasting disease. So from looking into chronic wasting disease, we have gotten some better ideas about this process. And the turning points about the relationship between prion and Alzheimer's disease, they came from some labs in Europe, actually, who did some experiments to nail down those connections. They might have been perceived initially as being a little speculative, but now other people have repeated them, and it seems to solve a lot of puzzles. So a specific example of a puzzle, it was known for a number of years that you can stage Alzheimer's disease and you can stage Parkinson's disease. Now, what that means is if you look at people that when they're very clinically affected, they have certain brain areas that are hit, and then when people have a milder case of disease, sometimes brains go to autopsy because of different reasons, like someone is a car accident, and you can actually see that they have sort of an early stage of Parkinson's disease or an early stage of Alzheimer's disease. Well, those stages where the disease is spreading through the brain were not random. They had a logic to them and a sequence. And it was known for Alzheimer's disease, it was known for Parkinson's disease, but it wasn't known why. But why does it have a sequence? But now we understand there's a prion-like mechanism where the bad protein in the wrong shape is spreading down what we call neuroanatomical pathways, but that's basically a fancy way of saying, like, the wiring, the brain has a wiring diagram, and it's like the infectivity gets into one circuit, and that circuit links to the next circuit, and into the next circuit. And because those circuits have a logic, when the bad protein spreads, it also has a sort of a stereotypic pattern in which it changes through these stages. So I think that idea of spreading of the bad protein from prion disease, it makes a good explanation for these phenomena that were seen by brain pathologists in the cases of Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease.
Well, are there similarities between the progression of Alzheimer's and, say, mad cow?
There can be. I mean, when you get down to the specifics, the particular brain area hit by mad cow is not the particular brain area that's typically associated with Alzheimer's disease. But mad cow is not the only prion disease, and the most common form of human prion disease is called sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and then when you analyze that, that breaks down into a few different versions. Some are more to do with the people having movement disorders, roughly speaking to do with the back of the brain, structures at the back of the brain, but some are frank dementias. And some of those do have some similarities to Alzheimer's disease, and there are some rarer genetic forms of prion disease that run in families, and some of those have quite striking similarities to aspects of Alzheimer's disease.
Well, if we focus on the Alzheimer's connection, then are we any further ahead in terms of cause or treatment or prevention?
Well, I think there's some new possibilities that open up. I mean, that Alzheimer's disease is a big field, so there's a diversity of opinion. The connection between what we would call the precursor prion protein and the sequence of bad events in Alzheimer's disease, that is one area of investigation. It's not to say it's the only area of investigation, but within that area, I think, yes, it does make you think there's some new possibilities, and some of this has already been reported and discussed in the scientific literature, that controlling the normal precursor prion protein is a new avenue to think about controlling Alzheimer's disease. Now, it may turn out that in the long run, Alzheimer's disease gets dealt with by a cocktail approach, that you might have two or three small molecule drugs, pills that deal with different facets of the disease. But if one of those pills deals with the precursor prion protein, then that's good. That's a contribution to tackling a very serious and common disease. We're cautiously optimistic that that's going to be an avenue that's going to yield good dividends.
Well, this research, what is the significance for our aging population? I'm a boomer. I think you're a boomer. And we're heading into that time where we're also being warned that there could be an explosion of Alzheimer's and dementia cases that we're going to have to deal with. So what do you see as being the significance of this research and what you're finding out?
Well, there's just going to be, unfortunately, an enormous patient population. I mean, the biggest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease is just chronological age, and both you and I sitting around the microphone are boomers, and there's going to be a lot of Alzheimer's disease. I think the old figures for Alberta, there's just about 40,000 people here already, and it's just going to increase. There's been projections in Canada, in the United States. It's just going to be an enormous burden on the healthcare system. each Alzheimer patient has, as it were, a constellation of other people who are affected in the family and caregivers, and it lasts, unfortunately, a long time. It's the long goodbye, so it's a protracted disease that has big impact on families, on society. It just ties up energy, and I think even if you can make a mild dent in it, it would have enormous repercussions, you know, literally millions on a global scale.
You're participating in an international conference, Prion 2013, and your topic is relating to something about the slow progression of prion infections. What's your message here? What does that mean?
This research started in a thread that goes back a few years. So we were interested in the members of different type of a family, not a family of people, but a family of proteins. So our brains are complicated. They make a number of molecules, but some of those molecules are prion proteins. One, the famous prion protein we've known about for years, but there's also another one that we discovered a few years back called Shadu, and well, you might think of it as like a cousin of the prion protein we'd known about before. And then when we looked in animals that had a prion infection, that we found out something quite unexpected, that this other cousin molecule disappears. And we looked at that, and it seemed to be something quite specific to prion disease, and that piqued our curiosity, because we know that this cousin molecule has a number of attributes similar to its other family members. So we wondered, well, maybe something similar is going on with the famous, well-known precursor prion protein that we've known about for years, that we sort of assumed was sitting there in a rather essential but uninteresting fashion, just as a precursor to make the bad prion protein. We thought it wasn't doing anything, it's sort of unchanging. Well, that's not the case. In fact, it changes dynamically as the prion disease progresses. So this was just not assumed, and when people make models of prion disease, they never factored this as part of the equation. But my lab, in collaboration with a lab at the US Prion Surveillance Center, which is at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, we looked at this regular precursor prion protein with some new analytical techniques and using them in a sort of two-step system, and we found these changes, and this is quite unexpected, but I think that also has the potential to explain this mystery of why prion diseases are so slow. We know that when a prion disease starts, the immune system is not really able to detect it, and therefore is not able to go into action to defend people. So if you take that literally, you might think, okay, well, these diseases should be very fast because the body can't do anything to stop them. But in fact, that's not the case. Prion diseases can be very protracted, drawn out. They can take decades in humans. And so that was an enigma. Well, we believe that the reason the diseases can be slow is that the sort of fuel for this conversion, making this bad protein, the amount of fuel is being reduced, that somehow the body is trying to fight the disease and it's reducing the amount of this protein that you need to make the bad protein, and that can explain how the diseases get so drawn out. And in fact, we can make mathematical relationships between how long a prion disease takes and then we need to know two factors we've now defined. One is the amount of the bad protein, but the other one, which is the new factor in the equation, is the amount of the precursor protein remaining in the body at near the time of the end of the disease. So once you know this extra parameter, this extra variable in equation, you can predict how long a prion disease can last. So I think it sort of solves a puzzle. A little bit of a mystery can now be put just into a number.
Well, does that mean then that you could possibly interrupt the process?
Absolutely. So now it seems like the body is trying to slow down the disease by reducing the amount of this precursor protein. So it seems like the body is almost halfway there to stop it. So maybe if we can understand how that molecule, as we call it, gets reduced, we can understand that process, then maybe we can just push it a little more, then we can go from a partially effective halting of the disease process to something that could be fully effective. So that's where we're headed, trying to understand, take apart that process to know how we can hit it, and then basically take a disease that's slow, and possibly we can make it so slow it just doesn't, it's not a disease anymore. That's where we're headed at the moment.
Some of your funding has come from the Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, now Alberta Innovates Health Solutions. And I understand that you've had a couple of students who are almost ready to publish their research. What were they working on?
Well, one is a postdoctoral fellow in my lab called Charlie Mays, a talented young scientist from the United States. So he's been working on this discovery I just mentioned to you, this modulation of the normal prion protein. And the other one was a PhD student called Agnes Lau, who just finished her thesis last summer and worked for me briefly as a postdoctoral fellow, and now is at the University Hospital in Zurich, and we're just putting the finishing touches to her studies that have, we believe, they give us an insight into spontaneous prion disease. I mentioned earlier that the most common form of human prion disease is called sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Sporadic means basically we don't know where it comes from. It seems to come out of nowhere. But my student Agnes Lau made some slight variants of the normal prion protein that make it more predisposed to being chopped up into little pieces, which we didn't expect, but also when we have this type of protein growing in cells in the petri dish, then they start to make the telltale signs of bad prion protein that are seen in common forms of human prion disease, that's say sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So we're just putting the finishing touches to those studies.
You've made it through the first 10 years. We're now looking towards the next 10 years. What is the direction that you think the research should go now?
Well, I think it follows on from some of my earlier remarks, this connection about the way that bad proteins move around the brain. I think a lot of laboratories are going to be leaning on that because it's just a new point of intervention. If a bad protein is, first it's in one brain cell and then it sort of emerges, let's say, a few seconds or a minute before it goes to the next brain cell, well, it's a new part of the process. You could intervene to stop that happening, to stop it spreading. So there'll be a lot of interest in that. Chronic wasting disease is still going to be important because it seems to be the most infectious prion disease, and so learning about that, well, there are animals out there with it, so we have to keep pushing on that. But also it may, because it's so contagious, it seems to spread more easily than other prion diseases. By understanding that, I think we may get some insights that are more generally applicable to tell us the ways in which proteins move around, and those insights could apply to more common human dementias. And this last piece, I think, is to keep pushing on this relationship, the inner life of the normal prion protein. It seems to be a very important determinant in the way that we hadn't imagined for regular prion diseases, but it also seems to feature in the cascade of bad events in Alzheimer's disease. So we'll keep pushing on that as well. Experiments or interventions that modulate that might have double type of benefit. They might be useful for prion diseases, but also as part of the defense against Alzheimer's disease.
With regard to the center here, what do you see then as being its capabilities? Where does it fit into this bigger picture?
Well, a lot of the research is tied up with what we call the logistics. That's the nitty-gritty of the type of equipment, the instruments we use to measure the disease. So we've been equipped with a center by provincial funds and some federal funds. So we have a research center that is able to look at all these different facets of the disease. We can look at infectious prion disease, but we could also look at a disease like Alzheimer's disease that doesn't spread from animal to animal, but it does spread from one part of the brain to the other. So we have the capabilities to pursue that. So we have some flexibility to follow the new directions that are opening up, and we're fully equipped, we're fully commissioned, we're open for business, and those are the types of experiments we're pursuing.
Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.